session number 245703.
Here's Plowright Reel 3. Now, we're talking about your time training at Weems Barracks, Canterbury. We now think probably November.
Yeah, November. I remember I'd finished 6 weeks by Christmas, my 6 weeks training, by Christmas 56. So that would suggest I came in the middle of November, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Which is about right, because I did 6 weeks at the Tower, you see.
And so What other training did you do? Did you do much tactical? I believe not. But
I can't remember any tactical training. I remember lectures from people with blackboards, but mainly I think about guns again and how to use them. I remember going to the storeroom to draw a kit. I can't remember any physical exercise per se, but we must have done that. I remember silly things like standing on the parade ground early in the morning freezing, because winters were colder then, and looking at the great tower, the great west tower of Canterbury Cathedral, and thinking, or the towers, and thinking, oh, what a beacon of hope, you know, the wider world. It wasn't so much a spiritual thought as just anything to be out. But I don't remember a lot about military strategy, or we must have had lectures about military law and things, you see, but I've put them out of my head.
Now, what about your relationship with the other cadets, or whatever you call it, potential officers?
By this stage, they were mostly my class, if you like, with a few exceptions. And one or two I kind of kept in touch with later, and one I met again, this is complete parenthesis and jumping on, but a man called Ingemels, who was a bit like me, a rather chaotic soldier, I think even slightly worse than me, so I naturally gravitated towards him. He later became a rather famous art historian and ran the Wallace Collection in London, and years later, as a BBC producer, made a programme about the Wallace Collection. There he was, Professor Ingemels, curator of the Wallace Collection. We hadn't met since those days, but we remembered fondly, as one does. So I remember him. I remember one who sang beautifully. It's an odd thing about army life that one's talents are compressed, but in a strange way come out. So you find out somebody's a poet, somebody's a singer, somebody plays the banjo.
What about the what you might call working class?
There were.
Did they stand out as working class things?
You see, there were hardly any, and those who were didn't stand out maybe because they were trying to be like us. I come back to the working class thing as a later development, because I didn't get to be an officer, as you will hear.
So how did what happened next?
Well, then WASBE comes up, the War Office Selection Board. I can't remember where that was, somewhere like Camberley. And I remember it as a day of absolute misery. It was a day, partly physical, partly brain, when you formed up in little groups, and this horrible Private Smart, who'd followed me everywhere, did bloody well, and you were asked to command your group in various things, like the one I particularly remember was two poles about 20 feet apart, a couple of barrels and a piece of rope. And the officer was saying, now this space between these two poles is a 100-foot abyss. And you've got to get your chaps across using the barrels and the piece of rope. Carry on. Well, I hadn't a bloody clue. At the end of it, three men had gone down the abyss and the rest were still waiting to cross. Things like that. Then you had to give a lecture. Then you had to do paperwork. I think it was a written exam. You had to drill soldiers. I wasn't too bad at that. And at the end of a long day, you were formed up and told whether you'd... There were sort of three categories. Absolute pass. Not pass this time, but promising comeback. And there was category C, which was hopeless. That was me. The brigadier, a very kindly man, a sort of Edward Fox character, drew me to one side and said, well, Plowright, I'll be quite honest with you. You haven't got the makings of an officer. Sorry about that. And I wouldn't bother coming back, but maybe you'll find a niche somewhere. So I went back to the Tower of London.
To
the Tower of London, because that was my sort of group place. I think I've got that right. I mean, it's possible I got it wrong, but I think I have. I think it's right. I went briefly back there, and various options came up, one of which was the Intelligence Corps. I mean, Intelligence Corps obviously was a mixture of things, but it quite often was a home for bright lads who weren't remotely likely to be officers, or brightish lads. And that was the next stage, because very quickly in January, February 57, I was sent to Maresfield Camp near Uckfield in Sussex as a member of the intelligence corps, still a private. And that's another chapter in the story.
Now, so you went there, what do you think, January, February?
I think possibly even January, early February 57 to Sussex, because getting off the train at Haywards Heath and busing to this camp in a rather lovely place that was almost in the grounds of a big house called Sheffield Park. It's still there. I believe it's Gurkha's or something now. And this was a different atmosphere again, because we started to play games, tactics. And people, there were lots of, the class structure was fairly wide, although there were a lot of potential officers failed, as it were, there.
Tell me a bit about that. Before you, I mean, your first impressions meeting your classmates or
yes, well, they were a mixture of people. There were the public school people, and there were the sort of grammar school. I mean, they weren't East End boys anymore, but they were people without posh voices and comfortable homes. But they all had to have some sort of a brain. Because we were being trained, I mean, again, I didn't quite know what we were being trained for, but we were really being trained to join the Secret Service in some form or other.
And how did they start their training?
Well, we started with politics, I mean, sort of the world, what it was like and what the war had been about. And obviously there were a lot of quite left-wing characters, because I think, if I'm right, that it was in the education and intelligence corps that a lot of the propaganda for Labour coming to power was spread amongst ordinary soldiers at the end of the Second World War. And some of those people were still in jobs as sergeants. Not the officers, but the sergeants and corporals and teachers. So they weren't foul-mouthed and shouting. They were rather interesting, educated people. Rather good actors as well. I remember some brilliant sort of reviews in the NAFI. The NAFI became a big place there.
Sticking to the political lectures.
Yeah.
So this was a review of the past. But what about the modern world?
We looked at the Cold War. We looked at the Cold War and the power groupings and theatres of activity, Malaya being one, Korea being another, general picture of communism across the world. I mean, I don't suppose the lectures were terribly deep. Professors from Oxford didn't come and talk to us, anything like that. But we got a sort of strategic look at the world governments and groupings. We did more drilling. We did a lot of field work in the sense of...
And what was the field work?
Field work was partly simple things like the CCF at school, but extended. You had to find your way to places. But then we did a very interesting exercise in the town of Lewes that I'll never forget, because it was like being in James Bond for an afternoon. But you had to dress up in civilian clothes. You were given a bit of paper that you didn't open. It was in an envelope until you were on a bus somewhere. And then it said, go to the... For example, this is not exactly right... Go to the main Barclays Bank in Lewes. Wait until you see a man in a brown Macintosh carrying a copy of the Daily Telegraph. Follow him. And when the guy in the brown Macintosh said, I knew who it was. It was a sergeant from the intelligence corps. I knew him. So you were meant to follow him without being seen. And he would do various things to try and lose you, disappear, and so on. So it was an afternoon of sleuthery in the sort of classic... spy mode, except that I don't think I ever got any secrets. I mean, I forget whether he was meant to hand you over a packet or something after a bit. Maybe he was. And then you were to report back on what you'd observed and keep notes, but without being seen to keep notes, that kind of thing. So it was, you know, low-level police work, really, that you were doing, with a view to, I suppose, eventually doing that in some theatre of war in some part of the world.
What else were you learning? Perhaps you might tell us just what the function of the intelligence corps was at that time,
I mean, I have to say again that the naivety and my general lack of political knowledge, although I was a historian by training, it was also medieval or 19th century history. I didn't know much about the world. I knew a bit about Suez. My father had been for it. Most of his friends hadn't. I knew it divided families and people in a way no other issue had. I didn't know anything about Malaya, which will start to creep in a minute. I just vaguely knew about the Iron Curtain, and I took a fairly simplistic view, I think, you know, that communists were probably bad and capitalism was probably right. I was moving away from the Toryism of my family because I'd always slightly identified with the have-nots in a little bit of a patronising way, but just, you know, that life was hard for people, and I didn't think that the sort of world that I had mainly lived in was the only one. I knew it wasn't, and there were injustices. I could see that. So my own political thinking was very naive. And I do remember maps, charts, pointing things out. Oh, we learnt, yeah, we did learn, I suppose, intelligent skills, like how to keep your eyes open, how to keep your ears open, how to make quick notes. We didn't learn shorthand or anything. Essential kit. I mean, it sounds silly.
How do they train you in doing
that?
Your eyes open?
Well,
see what I mean?
I think, again, exercises. You know, that it's a bit like the magnified version of that children's game where they show you objects on the tray for 30 seconds, cover it up, and you have to remember how many objects you saw. We might even have done that. You know, all that sort of thing.
What about the note-taking? Was there a format you were meant to adopt?
We just taught. We weren't, let's say, no shorthand, but probably we were just taught to listen for essentials, both in overheard conversations we might have done exercises in, or during formal lectures. But you see, it's interesting that I remember so little of the detail. What I do remember, and this is of no use to you, was reading whole novels in the bathhouse in the evening. I just loved the hot baths, which were fantastic, and I'd go in with an E.M. Forster novel at 7 o'clock, and I'd come out at 10 having read it, and, you know, roasted like a lobster. And that was delightful. We had weekends, or even evenings, on summer evenings, because I was there right through till July, I think. We'd go into Brighton. One of us had a car. And, you know, go on the pier. And again, there were girls if you were interested, but I wasn't yet into that. But one thing happened at...
Were you drinking?
Only mildly. In the Naffy, half a pint of beer. But there is something here that I've completely missed out, and I've got to get it right. I've missed out something that will drive you crazy, because it takes me back to Canterbury.
That's all right. What's that?
That we did do physical exercise at Canterbury in the gymnasium, and I was so bad at pull-ups on the bar that they said, you'll have to be sent to Shorncliffe for a three-week intensive PE course. Well, I slightly got the impression that this was somehow blankets and extra milk, but it wasn't. It was a marine course in the barracks at Shorncliffe, which are still there, the guards depot. And there I was put through the mill in terms of physical exercise in a way that's never happened to me before or since. Crashing along the beach with full kit in boots, and you know what those pebbly beaches are like there. Pull-ups and press-ups and bars and running and rope climbing. I thought I'd die, but I got extremely fit and rather happy. And
you enjoyed it?
Ended up enjoying it because I felt strong and good. And that barrack room was... I was the only stroke officer character there. And I do remember the other guys, most of whom were very interesting. We used to listen to the Goon Show in the barrack room. That was a great bringing together, as it was later in Malaya. It seemed to cut right across classes. The officer used to come in, everybody stopped their cleaning, and we gathered around the trestle table on the one radio to hear this extraordinary, surreal, crazy comedy, which everybody thought was great, because it's very military, of course. A lot of the humour's military. A lot of the situations are military.
So was it really that much of an event? Was that the programme you all listened to?
The only one I remember collectively listening to, because over the use of the radio there were arguments, and I brought a little wind-up gramophone, and I was into Beethoven, and I used to try and play it, and there was one bloke, aggressive guy, who didn't really get on. He came up to me and he said, if you don't turn that effing thing off, I'll smash it. He said, my grandma swinging a cat round her head can make a better noise than that. So there was no arguing with him. I forget what I did after that. But the main point about Shorncliffe was it was a three-week course, intensive, I think the full marine course, and route marches, long runs. I ended up a new man, came back to Canterbury, no better soldier, but physically much fitter. And so that was a real going back. I might slightly readjust. I might have gone to Uckfield, Maresfield, February, March, rather than January, February, because I think that delayed my exit from Canterbury. See what I mean? Delayed my Wasby. Sorry about that. And then here I am in the late spring, early spring, into summer of 57 in Maresfield, Uckfield, learning how to be vaguely an intelligence worker of some kind.
Yeah, you still haven't told me
what it was.
Well,
I don't think... I think it... There were two things it was for, because that became clear about halfway through. You could become a linguist, mainly Russian. Chinese wasn't on the map then, Russian. And go to places like Crail, and there's another place where Alan Bennett and people like that went and learn Russian, with a view to interpreting, decoding, that kind of thing. Or you could be sent to Special Military Intelligence Services, SMIS, S-M-I-S, which operated in various countries, and Malaya was one of them. And that was more about liaising with police, about documentation, fingerprinting, photograph deciphering, broad political strategy. But you see, I can't be very precise because it all is a wash of information for me now, which got more precise when I got to Malaya.
Now, were you trained in things like photographic interpretation at Maresfield?
No. Not that I remember, but we might have been shown photographs and chinagraphed them, looking for significant things. But we weren't taught to be photographers or how to develop darkroom techniques. But we might have been taught what to look for in an exposed photo and make chinagraph marks on them. We might even have been given exercises where we had to be given a blank photograph and we had to pinpoint anything of military interest, that kind of thing.
Now, so anything else about Maresfield do you remember?
Well, I remember how I came to go to Malaya, really, which was on a summer day. We were all gathered into the gymnasium and the corporal I rather liked said, right, now then, you're about to finish here. Anyone for Far Elf? Now, this is absolutely true, though you'll think I've made it up. I thought that was one of those islands that you get in the weather forecast. Thinking of Faroes or Pharaohs, wasn't I? And that I could foresee a lovely wild island and perhaps a job with a telephone and occasional and looking at wild birds and things. And I put my hand up. Right, so a lot of us did that. And that turned out to be Far Eastern Land Forces. And that was the simple reason that I ended up going on a troop ship to Malaya in the late summer, say something like August of 1957.
Now, what preparations were made before you went? I mean, what kitting out or special?
We were given tropical kits, kept our battle dress and things.
What was tropical kit?
Tropical kit was lighter uniforms. Again, awful, I don't remember what it was actually called. It was all the same stuff, but much lighter material. We were given, don't think we were given mosquito nets. I think that was all issued to us when we got there. In fact, a lot of equipment was issued to us when we got there, but I'm sure we were given some lighter kit and instructions and maybe anti-mosquito stuff. But again, I'm a bit blurred as to which side of the ocean that happened. We were told to expect disembarkation. We were probably given lectures on the Malayan situation. It was going to be from Liverpool, and I kept getting false alarms. So I was sent home, then recalled, sent home again. And my parents got fed up with saying goodbye to me. Because this was going to be about a year or more away. Finally disembarked with a group of people, including about 12 intelligence boys, lads, from Liverpool in, I would guess, late August, early September, 57.
Do you know the name of the ship?
Yes. Well, it'll come to me. I have a feeling it began with an O. That's awful. I didn't keep a diary in those days, unfortunately. If I say the Oritania or something, Mauritania. I'm probably wrong, but certainly it embarked. And now, important point, we couldn't go through Suez because of the canal. I mean, the crisis was over, but it was a no-go area. So we went round the Cape.
Now, what were conditions like on
the ship? The conditions on the ship, again, were a bit shocking at first because it was a huge hold with three levels of hammock, toe-to-toe, above middle ground. I think I had a ground hammock, but my toes were in the nose of the guy on the same level next to me, and the chap there's toes were in mine. So it was very unprivate and very hot. The one redeeming thing was that all the intelligence corps boys were lassoed into teaching the kids of the posh classes in the officers' bit. So we'd go for a lot of the day to the sort of officers' deck to teach the children. Actually, they weren't all posh class children because there were sergeants and corporals and people as well. But any kids, we taught them English, general subjects. And we were taught Malay by a specialist on the 3.5 weeks I think it took from Liverpool to Singapore.
Were you good at languages?
Yes. Yes, I was. I mean, good ear. And Malay is a lovely language to get quickly. It's very simple. The structure is easy. the tenses are non-existent. You just put a word in to make it future and a word in to make it past. Plurals, you simply say the word twice. I mean, there are subtleties in the language, beautiful subtleties, a lovely language, but it's not difficult to get the basics. And so,
in 3 weeks, though?
In 3 weeks, we were, well, we hadn't tried it out on anybody, but we were not bad.
Who was teaching you? Was it
an intelligence corps sergeant who'd been in Malaya on a previous tour. A nice chap. We were still wearing uniform. Don't think we wore civilian clothes then, but... you know, it was fairly relaxed on board ship. Obviously, you didn't do much drilling. There were chapels. Well, I do remember one odd thing I did. I had to be guard on the padded cells because there were cells for, presumably, people who were either mad or bad. But I don't remember ever there being anybody in there. I just remember standing there with my kit and my instructions and I think a gun and a little pouch with instructions in which I could, again, it sounds terribly pretentious, but I could slip Shakespeare's sonnets because I was highly literary. And I learnt about 12 sonnets by heart, of which 6 I think I can still do, to keep me from going mad from boredom. Otherwise, it was teaching, and a lot of sitting around rolling cigarettes. You see, it's, you're in the cigarette age then.
Did you smoke?
No. Again, I kept to my prim standards, but everybody else did, and I don't remember there being any rule about not smoking below decks. I mean, think of the fire hazard. No, there was a lot of smoking going on.
You weren't seasick?
I remember being a bit iffy, but then you sort of get used to it. I do remember the beauty of the journey. I remember things, no military interest, like flying fish the first time you see them. And I remember everybody being stirred by that. I remember the Lascar stewards who had a pretty hard time. Everybody was rude to them. And they lived this strange, hidden life, even lower than the soldiers, and came out. And I saw my first signs of racism, which I was to see again in Malaya, that, you know, anything that's black or brown or yellow is... ripe for abuse by your average soldier. Not necessarily from racist reasons, it's just you'd never seen them before, you were prejudiced against them, and the tendency to want to kick somebody who's, he quotes, lower than you.
It's a different age. How did you treat them? I mean, how did you
feel
again,
about them? Was it priggishness, was it a religious sense? I mean, I'd always had this, I think, Christian feeling that we were brothers. I'd stood up for a Jewish friend at school, the only act of courage I'd ever shown at school when he was being teased. I didn't like it, and I think I may have got chatting to some of the Lascars, and, you know, there wasn't much opportunity for socialising, but I certainly don't remember. I remember disliking prejudice from the start and not feeling part of it, and that was to become very important when we got to Malaya.
Anything else about the voyage? It's quite a long time.
It did seem a long time. We stopped a few ports. I can remember seeing the coast of Africa, but we didn't stop going down the side. We stopped at Durban. And there was a woman there, famous in the Second World War, called the Woman in White. Do you know about her?
Tell me about her.
I've forgotten her name. I've got a little cutting of her somewhere. She wore a big white hat and a big white dress, and she had a megaphone. And she'd been a sort of Vera Lynn of South Africa for the troops for years, and she greeted each troop ship singing There'll Be Bluebirds Over the White Cliffs of Dover and patriotic and moving songs. The sad thing was, by the time we were there, 57, she was a bit of a joke. The soldiers thought she was funny, and a lot of sniggering went on, and she was getting on a bit. But she was still there, and I remember being moved by her. And she greeted the boat in, and she greeted us when we went out. And we had about a day's leave in Durban. And we were allowed to go off, and I think we were allowed to wear civilian clothes. And I remember tramping down dusty streets. No, again, my ignorance. I didn't know about apartheid. And I saw benches that said blacks only, whites only, and was amazed. And I met a family in a shopping centre in Durban, white family, and they said, come to Mshlanga Rocks, which is a great beach, and we'll lend you a costume, you have a swim. And they were nice people, and they gave me wonderful food and the landscape, just getting to the beach. These great rolling hills, as I remember, and a marvellous road. But they were white, 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 the beach only had white people on it. I don't think they said anything outrageous, but I got somehow the impression that blacks weren't even considered as real humans. And that shocked me mildly, but I was away before I had time to become part of anything. And so we re-embarked, the woman in white sang to us again, and off we went. And the next port of call, I think, was Colombo, where I remember just big black crows flapping about. And I seem to remember going to Bombay, though it seems odd we went to both, but... might have gone, in which case it would have been Bombay first, wouldn't it?
I think so.
And then Colombo. And then no port until Singapore. The last 2 days, or day and a half, going down the Straits of Malacca. was very, very beautiful because it was very calm. We saw jellyfish, we saw flying fish. Don't remember seeing whales or sharks. And to our left, this strange country that we were coming to be part of. You couldn't see real jungle, or perhaps you saw a bit, but we saw these swampy areas and stubby sort of trees with tentacle-like roots. And we were looking for, and of course, all of us were full of excitement about this tropical place. And the heat, the sweat, the tin ear, that was beginning. We were all given stuff, ointments and things to stop infection and sweat. Powder.
Tin ear
is what you get between your toes and in the genital area, and it's from chafing. It is a sort of chafing of the skin, isn't it, which can get very infected and nasty. It was beginning then, and the MO on the ship would give us powder and paint of various kinds to stop that. And so we landed in Singapore, and Singapore in those days was quite a small place. The docks were the old docks with go-downs and wooden gangplanks and coolies carrying sacks on their shoulders. And for me, this was absolutely mind-blowing, really. Suddenly, my life and world exploded in light and colour and movement and, you know, people. Never seen such a world. It was like medieval Europe must have been, you know, and I'd read about that in history, but not experienced it. It was terrific. And that was Singapore, and we were disembarked, shoved onto buses, blazing hot. I remember the heat hitting you. The thing about heat of that kind is it is like a weight on top of you. It isn't just light. You seem to be pushed into the ground. It's partly nice and partly scary. Anyway, put onto the bus, and bussed off to Nee Soon Camp. Nee Soon, NEE SSON. I believe it had been a prisoner of war camp under the Japanese. It was, as I remember, these corrugated iron huts, extremely hot, brick and corrugated iron, with beds, brass beds. We might have had fans in there, certainly not air conditioning. And we arrived. Then I think we might have been given some more kit. You see, that's where the tropical kit might have been issued, mosquito nets. But very quickly, I was amazed, the sergeant said, even the same day when we arrived, he said, right, lads, nothing to do today. You can take time off, put on civvies, go into town if you want to. And I remember in a sort of Conrad spirit thinking, right, I put on, you won't believe this, I put on a flannel suit, I brought a nice flannel suit and a bow tie, and I walked into Singapore, about 3 miles in the heat, to ribald shouts from various people, and straight into a Chinese coffee shop, which I later found was out of bounds, as most of those shops were, and sat down, and I loved it from the start, and I ordered a huge glass of iced coffee, Kopi-O it was called, K-O-P-I-O-O-R, meant iced coffee, and it was milk, condensed milk and coffee, and chunks of ice, and I sat there with a straw, and I thought, and all round, typical Chinese coffee shop, coffee shop's interior, marble top tables round, wooden chairs, quite often with inlay in them, and mirrors that were inlaid, and sometimes engraved with pictures of old China, pagodas and things, and guys who wore wooden shoes, and women, clack, 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 wooden shoes, and shorts and singlets, who served you, and were very impersonal, no, not very impersonal, very sort of informal. And didn't seem particularly surprised to see me there. I was wearing my bow tie and it was out of bounds.
Now, why was it out of bounds? It sounds harmless.
Because it was harmless, but it was a thing about troops not fraternising, partly to prevent fighting matches, because, as I say, it could... I think the thing about the British Army, and this came out in my programme about the siege of Singapore that I did recently, the fall of Singapore, racism didn't take the form of killing people. And that's, but it would get you, there might be a punch up. Don't like your face. You've got to take your filthy wog face away. Or chucking a glass over the top of the bar when inebriated, and then a punch up, and then the military police coming. It was that sort of thing. And I think the authorities and perhaps the local people were trying to avoid those sort of confrontations. There were places you could go that were local, and later on up country it was much freer. But in Singapore it was quite strict. You were meant to go to the military clubs, the hotels that were inbounds, and certain designated places. But anyway, the military police didn't pick me up. Had a lovely afternoon.
You just stayed there?
I just stayed there. I might have done a bit of a wander, just amazed. My Malay was useful already because it was the lingua franca, even though they were mostly Chinese I was seeing. And so I could order the coffee in Malay and say thank you in Malay and pay in Malay. You know, we'd given a few dollars, must have been. And so all that was terrific, you know, excitement for me. I was working in another language.